Hi, I'm Mary Kate Fain, founder of 4W.
I'm Sasha White, and I am the co-founder of Plevity.org.
And this is Identity Crisis, a new show for gender-critical teens and 20-somethings.
This week, we are going to be talking about the concept of shame and kind of what does shame have to do with why people sometimes speak, why they sometimes don't speak and remain silent, the role of shame in helping bad ideas to disseminate, but also maybe even does shame have a place in society? Is 2021 going to be the year of kink shaming, as some people have floated on Twitter? So that's what we're going to be talking about today. But first, we have to do our ICYMI, or our In Case You Missed It segment, which is where we update you guys on important events in the gender critical world in 1 minute or less. So who's going first today?
I'll go.
Okay, perfect. 3, 2, 1, go.
Last Monday, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit heard oral arguments in the case of Hecox v. Little, the case in which a male college dropout is trying to argue that he has the right to compete on a women's college track team in Idaho. One judge in the case was particularly displeased with all of the arguments that he was hearing from the ACLU, pointing out that the issue was moot anyway, since Hecox was no longer in school, and he even called the arguments silly, which fully agree with you, Judge K. Thank you for that one. Hecox was represented in the case by the ACLU's Chase Strangio, who claimed that the entire purpose of the law is to exclude trans women and girls and only trans women and girls from sports altogether. Never mind the fact that that's ridiculous. No one cares about what extracurriculars certain kids do. Why is no one trying to ban trans kids from student government? Side note. But anyways, speaking of Chase, be sure to check out her interview in the men's magazine GQ, where she told a bunch of lies about a bunch of things.
Nicely done in just under time. Perfect. And well, the Hecox case is very interesting. I hope we talk about it more, MK. And it's just so aptly named. I'll just leave it at that. But also, I'd like to say that if people are curious, you know, the ACLU makes this claim that the trans sports bills will negatively impact what they call cis girls. And they claim that this will mean that cis girls are subject to invasive tests. Now, they claim that you can trace this claim to the Hecox case, because the other appellee in the case is Jane Doe, a quote unquote cis girl, who the ACLU is claiming fears that she would be subjected to invasive testing if her gender was questioned. So that's silly too, because every kid has to get a doctor's physical before they start playing sports. And well, I'm pretty sure the doctor can find that out.
The judge actually pointed out in this case is that this has not happened to Jane Doe. Like, literally no one ever questioned whether she was female or not. The reasons that she claims that she is afraid that she would be subject to this is because she's gender nonconforming. She wears pants, wears her hair short, and has like a more stereotypically masculine build. The judge pointed out, it was so funny, that most women don't wear dresses every day anymore unless they're religious. And he was basically like, has this happened? And the ACLU had to say, no, it hasn't happened, but she's very afraid that it will. And you could just tell that the judges were not buying it. So I'm optimistic that that appeal is going to go well.
Excellent. And can you send me the link so that we can link below that whole video of that case? Because it was on Zoom, right?
It was on YouTube, actually, live stream. But yes, I can. Yeah, perfect. I'll still send it to you, though. Okay. Yeah.
I listened just for a couple minutes. It's very interesting to hear Chase argue in court. So,
yes, some cognitive disconnect there with the visuals.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, Sasha, in 60 seconds or less, what news do you have for us today? In 3, 2, 1, go.
In news from Europe, Sweden's second largest hospital network, the Karolinska Hospital, has ended the use of puberty blockers for children under 16 as of, I believe, April 2021. And this is huge news because this is the first hospital to explicitly stop following the Dutch protocol. And the Dutch protocol allows for the administration of puberty blockers for age 12 and increasingly as young as ages eight through nine. And this is based on the WPATH, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, which has positioned itself as the leading expert that is the baseline for care around the world for transgender care. This change also heralds other changes around the world. For example, in the UK, following the High Court ruling that deemed hormonal intervention for minors experimental after the Kira Bell case. And so we're looking forward to seeing what other shockwaves come from this, and hopefully more will follow suit.
Thank you, Sasha. That's really good news. We're all really excited to see that children across the world are not being subject to this experiment anymore.
Yeah, exactly. You think of experimenting medically on children as the most dystopian, nightmarish, evil thing. And it's very disturbing to see it going on around the world and being supported and excused by all these people who should know better.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, that's the news that we have for you today. Up next, the episode.
Let's just start somewhere random and fun. What do you think of kink shaming?
Okay. So I think what we might actually describe as kink shaming, like going after a specific individual for their kinks, implying that there's like a bad person or something because of that, like that I don't really have a huge problem with, but I also don't really see it as particularly useful. But things that are often called kink shaming, which have nothing to do with shaming a particular individual, but are just criticizing kink as a whole, especially things around like BDSM or things that are actively harmful to women or can contribute to the objectification of women and violence towards women and all of like these really pornified ideas of what sex should be. I think criticizing that often gets called kink shaming, and fully support all of that. And I would highly encourage you to do that. And I mean, I personally don't think I would go after a person to make them feel bad unless I really like had a reason to go after that person individually, like as an actual individual. It's just not my style, but I also think that if someone wants to discuss their kinks in public, then they should be open to criticism about that, because we do know that sex is very political, especially for women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what you just said about in public, right? That's so important here, because people are trying to bring these things out into the public sphere and normalize them in the public sphere, like BDSM and those types of things, which have degrading elements, especially towards women. So, there is a social purpose that shame can serve. And it's not, like you said, that we want to make people feel bad about themselves. We definitely don't want to make women feel bad about themselves if they're engaging in these behaviors. They're probably already feeling bad about themselves. I mean, that's quite a judgment to make, but it's possible. In many cases, they are. We could get into that. It's sort of a different topic, but there might be a lot of, I mean, we know that there's a lot of shame connected to trauma, and we know that a lot of people who do BDSM are traumatized and are doing it. Sometimes they even say, this is how I cope with it. I reenact it in a way that I feel control over. They believe that it helps them deal with the shame, but then they want to extrapolate that outward into like, we shouldn't feel any shame to bring this outside our front door and bring it into society. Now this is going to be weird, but Milo Yiannopoulos.
Okay. Always with the conservative YouTube bro, Sasha.
I know. I don't know why these are the people that I cite, but it's because, you know what it is? It's because they like stimulate my thinking in a different kind of way, because I'm like just totally disagreeing with them. And so it just makes me think. So Milo Yiannopoulos, if you don't know, he is a provocateur. A few years ago, he was kind of on the scene as like this really flamboyant but conservative gay guy. And he just recently came out as straight, like as having changed to being straight. Did you not hear about
this? Isn't he married to a man? No, this is like total news to me.
Oh, fun. Okay, well, I get to be the one to break it to you. He is now claiming that he, has renounced the ways of his homosexuality. And
But he's married to a man, right? Like, did he tell his husband?
Let's check. Because he made it sound like he was... he had renounced the touching physically with other males. That's what he said, actually. Or personal life. He reportedly married his long-term boyfriend in Hawaii in September 2016. In March 2021, during an interview with right-wing publication LiveSite News, Yiannopoulos claimed to be ex-gay and stated that his husband had been demoted to housemate. Oh my God, that sounds like a brutal breakup.
Wow. Except they're still living together.
Oh my God.
Stone cold Milo.
No, but he wasn't stone cold in this interview. He was very emotional and vulnerable, and it was really weird. It was really sad and weird, and he seemed kind of broken. I didn't listen to the whole thing. But what I wanted to bring up in regards to shame was apparently he's working on a book, or he has a book about the of course, he's always going to be a provocateur. So it was something like why we should bring back hate, or why we should bring back shame, or something. And we're off to a great start. His point was that we've crushed in ourselves the impulse that we have to shame others when we feel repulsed by them. And he's saying that when No, you're right, because there is the flip side of the coin, right? So when you feel repulsed by something, what he is saying is that that is a human instinct that we should actually honor and even act on, because it means that we are instinctually picking up something that is wrong. And he's saying that now you're not allowed to feel that unless you're shaming the people who feel that. So, AKA the cancel culture that I think you're referencing.
Do you know what this reminds me of, actually?
What?
This reminds me of our friends over at Blocked and Reported. And Jesse Single has repeatedly said that he thinks that nerds should have been bullied more, and that that would have solved all the world's problems. And so
doesn't he know that he would have been bullied too? I can tell.
Maybe he was bullied, and that's why he turned out fine. But seriously, I think that, like, the common thread here is this idea that sometimes there is a good reason to, you know, give someone a hard time for something about themselves, because maybe it's not a good thing, and that we should, I'm not saying I agree with this, but that maybe we should embrace that. That's what they're getting at. But then these, you know, Milo also, I guess I'm assuming here, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would assume that he's against things like cancel culture. And how is that not just public shaming?
Right. So he thinks that, so from what I got from the part of the interview that I listened to, he thinks that the cancel culture is essentially the only shaming we're allowed to do nowadays, which is like shaming people who feel that, who express that repulsion.
I see. So if you feel, okay, but I feel like even that is an admission that, like,
that it's
something
bad
about the people, or that we are what they say we are, you know. So, okay, I'm canceled for transphobia, right? But, you know, I'm not transphobic. I'm not scared of, nor do I hate trans people, or people who identify as trans. But, you know, this assumption of Milo's would assume that I'm repulsed by people who identify as trans, and that's simply not true. You know, I'm repulsed by patriarchy, objectification of women, of the I don't know if I would give that I am repulsed by this. It's not really that feeling at all. For me, it was more of a logical thing that I had to get to, because, you know, I was a liberal feminist trans activist for a long time. And, you know, because I wasn't repulsed by it. And then I, like, logically had to walk myself to this position.
Right. Yeah, that's so true. And another thing that it made me think about was the idea that, you know, well, the question, does shame actually make people better, or does it make them worse?
I definitely don't think that shame is effective in changing how people actually think or feel. But I think it can be very effective in changing how people behave. And I think that that's sort of the purpose that, you know, this whole public shaming ritual of cancellation has, is changing the behavior of people because they feel ashamed of themselves. And so, you know, you start to see these, like, hostage apology letters coming out where they're like, I never meant to hurt a blah, 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 blah. I acknowledge my privilege and I'm an oppressor and I'm a horrible person. I acknowledge it. And then they have to, you know, flog themselves publicly. And then other people see this and they feel ashamed for the similarities that they have with this person who is being publicly shamed and therefore don't speak. And so yeah. I do think shame is very effective in controlling behavior, but I don't think it changes the person, their thoughts, their feelings. And I think that when shame is planted and then allowed to fester, it can really be incredibly damaging and toxic to people. And I think that we see a lot of that in a lot of people who do go on to do very heinous things. Yeah, so I think that for the most part, no, although there is actually a social psychology phenomenon where people's behavior does actually change their belief. And it's kind of like a reverse opinion forming where people normally assume that opinions are formed and then you do the behavior based on the opinion. But I don't remember the name of it, of this theory, but this one theory basically stipulates, maybe I'll find it in link below or something, but this one theory stipulates that people actually don't always have the capacity to form an opinion before the behavior, like either yes or no, is required. And so they just do whatever it comes naturally to them or is the easiest thing in the moment, has the like lowest barrier of entry. And then that actually, then they decide, oh, well, I did this, so my opinion must be that.
Right.
And I do think that there can be some degree of that. It's kind of like the thing where, you know, they say, if you feel unhappy, then you should just smile. And yeah. like you'll just start to feel happier in time right. from doing that. It's kind of a similar thing. And so I think if you're publicly out there faking that you've changed and you're some like apologetic, like reformed person, I think that it's most likely to breed shame because it's like kind of a closeted situation where you're hiding your true self. But I think there could be people who genuinely do actually change their insides to match their outside mm-hmm. behavior.
Yeah, I mean, like what you're saying is so true. Like the brain is always trying to figure out how to make itself in agreement with what you're doing, what your actions are. So
cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, because the brain doesn't like that cognitive dissonance. It wants to solve it. So if you're not being true to yourself, then your brain will try to make rationalizations and justifications of why it makes sense to continue to be as you are. And it's also like how they say, if you don't feel motivation, just start working, because then the motivation yep. actually comes after the discipline or the action or whatever.
Very true.
Or they say like, if you don't feel the presence of God, just start praying. Don't wait until, you know, so it's kind of like that. Yeah. But I think this is almost evidence that people completely coming from the other side. If you don't feel brave enough, maybe just start speaking, and then the feelings of bravery and courage might actually oh, yeah. come after the action.
That's totally true in my case. I mean, if you watched our last episodes, then you know that I was not necessarily trying to be this like public person taking a stand, but I said a little thing. I was scared to say it, but I said it anyways. And then the bravery came after when, mm-hmm. you know, when you're thrown in the deep end. So I do think that's true to some degree. And so maybe that's an argument that shame does change behavior. But then again, I think that it can change behavior in other ways too. I think that it can have this, you know, what we were kind of talking about before, this like festering impact. I mean, think about, for example, like I just mentioned, being closeted, like being gay and being ashamed of that and hiding it. And, you know, there is so much shame from certain communities still put on people who are gay. And we know that the impact that that can have on mental health and how damaging it is. And I do think that a lot of toxic behavior can come out of that. And I think in society, a lot of times the things that we are the most ashamed of are the things that we are kind of, you know, fighting the hardest. It reminds me of, you know, you always hear, it's basically like a meme at this point, or like a trope, the like Republican anti-gay politician who's like buying male prostitutes, you know,
right.
like, you know, it's right. this acting out of the shame in this like really I think it's called a reaction formation in psychology, is you have a feeling or thought that you don't like, your brain doesn't like that you have this, you have the cognitive dissonance, you're like, this doesn't align with what I think about myself. And so you act out in the extreme opposite. And I think that like shame can do that, because shame is what causes the cognitive dissonance. You're a good person, you're a nice white Christian man, and you know, so you shouldn't be gay. And then you feel shame because, like, you know, you've been told that this is wrong, and then it causes this extreme negative reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, so is the extreme negative reaction in that case like spewing the homophobic rhetoric?
Yeah,
or
yeah,
the buying yeah. prostitutes?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's true. We see that, right? It's like the you are most bothered in the world by what you feel you have in yourself. That's sort of a cliche, but it's something along the lines of what you're saying here. Like, people who are most vocally against something, it might be because they feel that within themselves.
Yeah, I think I know what you're saying. Basically, it's this idea that when you see someone do something negative and then you react by, you know, trying to publicly shame them or something, it's sometimes, maybe not always, but sometimes less about, I feel impacted by what they did and I want it to not happen because it caused like suffering in the world, and you know, I want to reduce the amount of suffering in the world, but rather it's because I see a part of me in that and I want to like lash out and punish that side of it because it's like bad, like
right.
get back in your corner. You're not supposed to let that out. And almost the idea, like when you see someone else do it, it's this little reminder, like, I could do that. And you don't even want to be tempted that way. Like, maybe it's an actually bad thing, but maybe it's even just something that, like, you know, you shouldn't do, like societally, like speak out about something or, you know, criticize a particular person. And so maybe you lash out at that person because you kind of like secretly want to do that thing, but you're like, I need to like, you know, push that down so that I don't risk putting myself in danger by actually doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that applies to, I mean, do you think that the wokerati are a bit like that? Because they've sort of designated themselves as the police of what everyone else can say or tweet or write or think. Yeah. And then a lot of times they've got problematic tweets in their past, like stuff that is actually offensive that me and you never would have tweeted. You know what I mean? Like,
it's like that Teen Vogue editor who was canceled, the new editor in chief, and I think, and she was a Black woman who was canceled for some tweet from her past. I think it was like anti-Asian or anti-gay, maybe both. And then it turns out that one of the people who was most prominently criticizing her in the workplace and trying to get her canceled had some other sort of racist tweet in her past, or anti-gay or something, anti-something tweet.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
It really was that exactly that you just said of, I am like ashamed of my own past and I, you know, I'm lashing out at this opportunity to prove that I'm not who that I used to be. I'm not that person from 2008 who made that tweet. And I mean, she's probably not. Like, most people are not who they were, you know, when they were in high school. That's when a lot of these tweets happened, even for this editor. She was quite young. And we see this, I think, a lot in the race debate, you know, even just moving beyond gender, this idea of shame from, and people, you know, using shame, especially when they maybe have something that they're harboring internally themselves of, you know, I need to shame you for your racist behavior, but like probably because they actually know that they have racist ideas and they're trying to like prove that they don't by being like the most anti-racist by calling this person out. And then you dig back like 5 years and you're like, oh no, you did the same thing.
Right. You're literally calling people trannies and N-words all over the place. Like, you need to stop. But no, they've stopped then. The problem is they've started policing other people. But yeah, and that, you know, I was just listening to Ibram X. Kendi's TED Talk about white privilege.
Mm.
And he said that the heartbeat of racism is denial. And the heartbeat of anti-racism is confession. And I was so struck by that because of, first of all, how religious that sounds.
Yeah.
And second of all, this element of shame, because you have to confess in order to become an anti-racist. And he says you are either racist or anti-racist. He says that not racists are just racists in denial. So you cannot get out of this trap.
Yeah.
It's a Kafka trap, which we've talked about before in our fallacies video.
Yes. And, you know, we probably talked about this in that video too, but it's very white fragility, very Robin DiAngelo of this idea that the only people who are anti-racist are the ones who are loudly proclaiming all of their racism and saying,
precisely,
yes, I'm a white person and therefore I am inherently racist in this society. And like, I, you know, put a black square in my Instagram because of that or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the only way you can actually be anti-racist is to like confess your racism. Exactly what you said is so true. And there's no idea that you could just actually like not be racist. Like that concept is just out the window. Like everyone is racist. Like we're all just racist. And like you can't do anything except for say that you're racist to prove that you're anti-racist. Yes. Exactly right. It's a Kafka trap. And I do think a lot of this is based on shame. I think that people probably actually do have some degree of racism in them. Like, I'm not, you know, full white fragility or anything, but I think that especially the people who are going around spouting this and talking about race 24/7, I do think that, like, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of these people, you know, actually did harbor either some racist sentiments or in the past they had these racist sentiments and they feel ashamed of that because, I mean, honestly, it's not a great thing. And like, I do think that's an actual moral thing. And so sure. Yeah. Feel ashamed of that. But then they take the shame and like try to put it on everyone else. Like, well, because I feel ashamed about my past, and like you have to feel ashamed about your present and like your everything. And it doesn't matter that it was in the past. You know, people aren't allowed to just like move on and grow and like learn from their past and become better people. So, and, you know, maybe actually this kind of brings back what you were saying about forgiveness. I was skeptical at first. But I do think there's some degree of forgiveness in this of, you know, being able to just forgive yourself and say, yeah, okay, maybe I did have these thoughts growing up. And like, maybe I was raised in a culture that taught me these, you know, toxic or unethical beliefs, but I learned and I grew and I don't hold those beliefs anymore. And I'm actively trying to, you know, make the world a better place. So you can forgive yourself. You don't, and maybe once you forgive yourself for, you know, what your situation was prior, you can not be out there trying to throw other people under the bus to prove how not racist you are. Sorry, anti-racist.
Exactly. No, that's a great point. And, you know, when Ibram X. Kendi said about confession is the heartbeat of anti-racism, it also made me think about different kinds of confession and the way that when you are sort of compelled to confess, that is quite different from when you confess voluntarily. And the voluntary confession can really, I think, bring about a lot more true remorse, and it comes along with that. Whereas the other form of the compelled confession can be a false confession. It can be, you might lie, you might feel the exact opposite way inside.
You know, this is a really like natural and normal thing that we see in everyday lives too. Think about in your relationships when you're, you know, you're having a fight with someone and they're like, what do you want from me? And you're like, I just want you to apologize. And they're like, fine, I'm sorry. Okay. Are you happy? Are you happy? No, you're not happy. Of course you're not happy because they didn't genuinely mean it. They just apologized because they were forced to. And I think we see that a lot with these, you know, hostage apology letters on online that people post because they're never good enough. You know, whatever the person says, it's never good enough. They always get torn back apart.
I mean, it just opens them up for more.
Yes. Tell me a time when someone has posted an apology letter after they got called out and the internet was like, oh, we forgive you. Thank you. Let's move on. Never. No.
It just makes it validates the accusations.
Yes, absolutely. But then on the other hand, think of, you know, in your relationships when, you know, you have a fight with someone and then you go back to them afterwards. I do this all the time because it always takes me a minute to cool off and realize I'm wrong. Then you go back and say, hey, I'm sorry, I was wrong. And how much more valuable that is to someone than when you yell at them, yes, all right, I'm sorry, okay? You know, you're right that when you genuinely come to this conclusion on your own and you have the freedom to actually have really realized, like, yes, what I did hurt someone and I want to move on from that, that I think is that that isn't shame necessarily. I think that's maybe guilt. I think mm-hmm. that's realizing that I have responsibility and remorse for this thing and I want to make it right. Shame is this more external pressure that, like, you wouldn't think that it was morally wrong if there weren't people telling you it was morally wrong. And I think that most people do have a little bit more of a compass than that. And they can guess whether or not something was right or wrong without other people telling them so. And so if you, like, get to a point where you actually feel guilty about something, then you are acknowledging, yes, I've done something wrong, and then I'm seeking out the opportunity to make it right. And those, mm-hmm. I think, are very powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is from psychologytoday.com, so obviously not, this is a bit of a pop source, but they define guilt and shame how you did in a very, they're two different things. They say guilt is defined as a feeling of responsibility or remorse for some offense, crime, wrong, etc., whether real or imagined, whereas shame is the painful feeling arising from the consciousness of something dishonorable, improper, ridiculous, etc., done by oneself or another. Ooh. So shame, by this definition, is very much about the social, yes. The eyes on you, the humiliation, the mortification of
words,
of judgment,
dishonor, improper. Mm-hmm. Okay, any Avatar fans out there? I mean, think about Zuko and you know, he's trying to get back his honor because what he actually did wasn't anything wrong, but he's feels dishonored and he needs to get back his honor. It's a very similar thing. And think about how toxic that turned for him. Sorry if you don't watch Avatar, but
what's a brief summary? What did he do?
Okay, brief summary. The guy stood up for not doing this like war crime when he was a kid against his father, who was a warlord. And then his father permanently scarred his face and banished him and because he had dishonored himself. And so he then internalized that. He felt shame because of that. I don't think he felt guilt. What he did was, you know, pretty much the right thing. But he felt shame because his whole culture saw him as the banished prince. Now he's dishonored. And he became this very angry, immature, pent up man who was trying desperately to get back his honor by doing what was expected of him, but that ultimately wasn't the right thing to do. And his journey was really forgetting about the shame and the dishonor and moving on to find a way to actually resolve his genuine guilt around the things that he had done since then and to, you know, come to some sort of redemption. Anyways, you should watch Avatar.
And what's so interesting about that is that in that case, the shame and the guilt worked towards such different ends. So like if we were to apply that to our woke culture, cancel culture, gender critical, you might be shamed into going along with the orthodoxy, but then you might actually feel guilt inside for going against what you knew was true and right. And this, you know what, I'm going to quote Dumbledore again. Like this is a Harry Potter
themed
podcast. Yeah, every single time. But Dumbledore said, it's one of the most famous ones. There will come a time when you will have to choose between what is right and what is easy. Is that the quote? Yeah, something like that.
That's right.
So guilt and shame are these two different things. The shame is more about social ramifications, yeah, and the way you're treated socially, and guilt is more internal, and it's more about your honest assessment of what you think is right and wrong.
Yeah, I think that's a good differentiation. And I do think that sometimes, you know, guilt gets a bad rap, like, oh, you shouldn't feel guilty when you do XYZ thing that maybe it was a hard choice you had to make. I actually think that's okay, because what you're feeling is, you know, sometimes when you make a choice, there isn't a decision that hurts no one. And if you feel guilty, right, that doesn't mean you did the wrong thing, because the other option might have been much worse. But you can still feel, you know, responsibility for the hurt that was caused by the choice that you felt like you had to make. So I think that guilt is actually much healthier. And shame, on the other hand, is really the social pressure. I mean, it's just peer pressure. It's just bullying for the most part. And so I guess, you know, going back to what we were talking about in the beginning of the episode is there a place for shame? Maybe rather instead of trying to shame people into, you know, doing the right thing or adopting the belief that we want them to have, we should actually try to make them understand when they're, the things that they're doing actually do hurt people. And I also think that that gives someone the chance to fairly and critically analyze, did I actually hurt someone? Or is this the sort of thing that I actually need to take any responsibility for? You know, I think hurt feelings are, you know, sort of this weird gray area where, like, maybe you did say something really mean, but also you can't control the feelings of someone else. You could say something totally innocuous. You could say, like, you know, oh, I really like your plant. And that person could have their feelings hurt for some reason. And you have no idea why. You have no control over someone's feelings. But then there are actions that you do sometimes where you know, like, okay, yeah, I really was over the line on that. That's not who I want to be. And those are the things that you want to try to take responsibility for. So that's what I would say the difference is. And when I think, you know, shame, I guess I just don't really see a huge role for shame in a productive, healthy society. I think people will naturally feel guilt if they understand that they genuinely did something wrong, and that's on them.
So that brings us to the end of our episode all about shame, and we hope you guys enjoyed it.
Definitely feel free to follow us on social media. Check out Plebity and 4W on Twitter, and be sure to hit the subscribe button somewhere and the little notification bell so that you will see us every time we are premiering on YouTube. And don't forget to check out this week's column. We'll be talking a little bit more about shame and how it can impact you and some of the sort of toxic aspects of that.
And if you guys want to help support us continuing to create Identity Crisis, you can sign up on the Plebity Patreon page, which will go towards the two of us and covering the cost of producing this show for free.